For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. For more information, visit faith.yale.edu.
This is a sort of a vision of life that says that the most important thing about your life is discovering that way of being human that is your way, that's particular to you, to who you are. And so these questions about authenticity end up being absolutely essential. Who is my most authentic self? What is the shape of that self? And then how can I actualize that person? How do I become who I most truly am? That's the quest of my life. And so many of these Disney films are centering this quest, the quest for the authentic self.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Hey, friends. Before we jump into this week's episode, I wanted to highlight an opportunity, an invitation for you, our listeners. As you may know, the Yale Center for Faith and Culture teaches a Yale College undergraduate course called Life Worth Living. It's over-enrolled every semester it's offered. It's the most popular course in Yale's humanities program. And now a version of that course is available to the public. Director of the Life Worth Living program, Matt Crosman, is teaching a 7-week online course from May 4th to June 15th. The course will cover 7 questions. What does it mean to belong? To whom are we responsible? How does a good life feel? What does it mean for a life to go well? How should we live? What role does suffering play in a good life? And finally, what should we do when we fail? You can apply and register over at gracefarms.org/life-worth-living. And the link is at the top of this episode's show notes. To give you a teaser of the kind of conversations that are happening in the Life Worth Living approach, today we're airing an episode about authenticity, individualism, and the self as portrayed in the Disney films Frozen and Moana. I asked Matt Crosman to say a little bit about this spring's Life Worth Living online course and cue up that conversation. Matt, thanks for coming on to talk a little bit about the course that you're going to be teaching, Life Worth Living at Grace Farms.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's going to be a good experience.
This is a course that is normally taught to Yale undergrads. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this course is being applied from the Yale context to the public.
These community courses are really exciting opportunities for us to sort of slice our material a different way. So with the undergraduates, we're talking about a series of traditions and sort of looking at those ways of life. In the community courses, we begin with those questions. And so on any given week, then we're asking a question like, what does it mean to belong? Or what should we hope for? Or what's the role of suffering in a good life? And we read a range of different authors coming from a range of different traditions and different perspectives. And it's really exciting. You get sort of, you know, Confucius in conversation with Alice Walker, or mm-hmm. Toni Morrison in dialogue with the rabbis. Mm. And it just makes for really rich conversations each week. And what it allows is that each participant then spends the week following our discussions, you know, hopefully they carve out some time to do their own writing and answering this question for themselves. And so by the end, you've got sort of 7 little short pieces of personal writing that are your provisional working sort of answers to some of life's most important questions.
Yeah, that reminds me of one of the most poignant questions that I've heard come out of the Life Worth Living context. And that's the author that you're reading. If that idea were true, how would your life have to change?
That's the pivotal question, right? If we don't ask that question, then we're just doing religious studies or something like that, which is fine. It's a good question, right? A fine thing to try to understand how other people see the world. But what makes this unique is actually asking that next question, saying, well, what if this perspective were true? What if it is true? Now, what do I do with my life? You know, Robin Kimmerer, a member of a North American Indigenous nation, and also, you know, PhD botanist, proposes that maybe what it means to lead your life well is to aim to become indigenous to a place. It's this like really compelling sort of picture of what it might mean to be a human being. But on one hand, you could stand at a distance from it and say, oh, that's really compelling. I'm so glad there's a group of people who sort of see life that way. But that's not why she's writing. She's inviting you to consider that your life might find its meaning precisely in figuring out what it might mean to become indigenous to the place where you live. Turning that corner makes all the difference.
So in this episode, you and our friend Ryan McAnally-Lins discuss one of those visions of flourishing life that is out there in the broad culture and is particularly represented in Disney films. And so I wonder if you'd give us a little bit of a teaser for that conversation, and what visions of the good life do you see emerging from the Disney films Frozen and Moana?
Well, so in the Life Worth Living course at Yale, we actually spend a unit on what we call an expressive individualism. Now, most of the people who we read, you know, we read Oscar Wilde, we read Charles Taylor. This is a sort of a vision of life that says that the most important thing about your life is discovering that way of being human that is your way, that's particular to you, to who you are. And so these questions about authenticity end up being absolutely essential, right? Who is my most authentic self? What is the shape of that self? And then how can I actualize that person? How do I become who I most truly am? That's the quest of my life. And so many of these Disney films, right, are centering this quest, right? The quest for the authentic self. We actually encounter this idea in one of the very first sessions in the course that we'll be doing at Grace Farms, where we read Charles Taylor, who lays out exactly this idea, and he just calls it the ethic of authenticity. This sense that among all of our responsibilities, our most essential responsibility is our responsibility to ourselves to become our most authentic selves. This is just one of these like fundamental sort of visions. Until you sort of hear it articulated as a vision, you don't realize just how much like it's in the water that we swim in. And that's just like one of the really important things that we do in the Yale course, and then we do in these community courses as well. It's just like give ourselves a little bit of like critical leverage to think about maybe a lot of the ideas that are so present and so like in our faces all the time that we never really consider them. So it's one of the things that I'm excited to start out with in that course, and always is just a really meaningful interaction.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So listeners, you can sign up for this at gracefarms.org/life-worth-living. And we expect spots to fill up rather quickly. There's not a ton of space. So if this is something you're interested in, we'd recommend that you get going on that this week. The course runs from May 4th to June 15th. And Matt, anything else before we run today's episode?
Thanks, Evan. You know, we're excited. It's pandemic times. We can't be together in person, but the exciting thing is we're able to offer these sorts of experiences to a broad audience from all across the country and around the world. So I look forward to meeting some of our audience and some of our extended community online in the course in these coming months.
Thanks, Matt. And now today's episode, You Do You, Learning the Ethics of Authenticity from Disney's Frozen and Moana. Thanks for listening.
So every semester when we teach Life Worth Living, one of the sort of big sort of visions of the good life that seems to be lurking around the edges all the time is this like what we sometimes call the you do you vision of life. Students come in and there's just a sort of assumption that whatever my vision of a life worth living is, it has something fundamentally to do with who I am, my particular story, where I come from. And we've had some fun sometimes talking about what that might have to do with where we see this in some of our, you know, in some of the cultural touch points. We've been going back and forth a bit, in fact, about like a couple of Disney films.
Yeah. So I, for one thing, I have a young daughter who was watching Frozen a lot.
I also have a young daughter.
Yeah. And that meant I was watching Frozen a lot.
Right.
And I felt like I needed to redeem this time in my life. so I started paying attention and found like this really surprisingly robust version of the you do you vision of the good life. But that vision of the good life comes in like more and less robust, like shallower and deeper versions. And a lot of what happens is when we think about it, we think, oh, if I have that reflex, that's a shallow reflex, right? You do you. That's kind of like, oh, blah, that's the culture. If I'm really thinking about the good life, I got to do something different than that. And we don't consider the possibility that there might be kind of like a deep ethical ideal there. And that's where I think like reading Charles Taylor's so helpful, because he gives that account of how that came to be.
Right. So Charles Taylor is sort of at a different cultural moment. He's describes a sort of early version of the sort of you do you ethic. What Taylor identifies is that there are these young people who are saying the way of life that's really significant is a way of life that is unique to me. Only I can live this sort of life. And that makes them say some things that Taylor wishes they wouldn't. But he also thinks that when the sort of pearl clutching response comes, but if to be you is to somehow have a sort of unique moral horizon that's particular to you, then what happens to any sort of sense of universal human values?
Ah, relativism. It's that kind of, this is an early 90s book, right? And that was when this was like first starting to be a really big thing.
Right. So Alan Bloom has written about the closing of the American mind. Some like folks on the pearl clutching side of the spectrum are saying, yes, this indeed is the big problem. And Taylor walks in to try to say, well, hold on, the thinnest version of this, of the sort of you do you slogan, it's got some serious downsides. If it's really going to just slide into moral relativism, that's A, philosophically incoherent, and B, you know, probably culturally disappointing. So it would mean that all we could ever do is sort of, you know, give ourselves over to moral parallel play, where you do your thing, I do my thing, and hopefully we don't harm one another along the way. All there is sort of a procedural.
And when we do, we have like no resources for hashing it out. Right? Yeah. It's just completely end of the conversation.
And this is what, you know, and you can sort of see a sort of, I mean, there's a moral ideal here of authenticity mixed together with adolescent, get out of my way, man. So Taylor's able to critique that side, but at the same time, try to say, hold on, there's actually a deep ideal. And that has become for us, I think, not only like just like an insight about this particular way of life, but even like a way of relating to culture that we talk about quite a lot around the office is, oh, this is a really sort of compelling way like to engage in culture. Can we look at things that maybe are ideas that are not being expressed, ideas that haven't become their best selves yet, right? That we can sort of help describe or articulate a little bit even more charitably.
Yeah. And so I'm watching Frozen, and I'm actually seeing the same sort of thing happen with the reception of Frozen.
Yeah.
Right. So Let It Go is everywhere. It's just an astonishingly good anthem, right? And it is really easy to read it as an anthem of you to you, of this ethic of authenticity in a kind of shallower version.
Snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen.
Before I let this go any further, it can be helpful at this point to back things up a bit. Clearly, well, one can only assume, Disney was not intentionally writing Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor's ethics of authenticity into the script. Nor was Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, the songwriters for Frozen, just trying to bait theologians and ethicists into reacting to the movie. Or were they? The point here is, Taylor theorizes and expounds a historically and culturally sensitive approach to understanding what matters to us as people in the world today, what values are there, and they run so deep in our entertainment and stories and mythology that of course they can be even seen in the movies we show our children. And I'm right there with Ryan and Matt. The Frozen soundtrack is still ringing in my ears. So here's a bit of a step back to contextualize Taylor's ethics of authenticity and find it even in Elsa's Let It Go lyrics.
It may be necessary to back up here and say a little bit of where Taylor thinks that that ethic comes from. So he charts this kind of centuries-long process where in Western Europe mostly, there's this kind of new, increasingly common new way of understanding the human self. He calls it the disengaged self. So this is roughly like the 16th through the 18th centuries. You start to get this picture of the human being as kind of imposing through its rational will an order on an unruly nature, an unruly kind of self, an unruly body, unruly emotions, all that sort of stuff. Well, that sounds a lot like what happens with Elsa at the beginning of Frozen.
Right.
Right. She's got her powers. They seem to be dangerous. And what do her parents say? You've got to control it. Got to control it. And she's saying, conceal.
Conceal, don't feel.
Yeah, conceal, don't feel. Be the good girl you always have to be.
Don't let them in. Don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel. Don't let them know.
Disciplined, buffered self.
Yeah, this is the kind of self that Taylor sees coming onto the scene. And just as, I don't know about you, but I have this kind of like cringing reaction to that watching Elsa. That's just like, that can't be the right way to deal with this, right?
Yeah, this can't be, yeah.
And that's an impulse that comes from the same sort of expressive individualist reaction to the disengaged self that Taylor charts, right? So people like the early 19th century romantics are thinking, we need to raise up nature feeling. And this is the kind of soil from which the ethic of authenticity comes from.
That's what's going on inside us when we see Elsa, when we hear Elsa saying, conceal, don't feel. We're supposed to be able to recognize that as, oh, that's the wrong response.
Yeah.
Which is maybe what sets up Let It Go.
Exactly. And that's why Let It Go, that's why the shift from the minor key to the major key and Let It Go is so, so satisfying, right? Because you've had this kind of like brooding tension and suddenly it's released because she has this realization, I don't have to deal with that crap. Mm. Like I can be me. Mm. And she lets it all out. And the whole song is just like a point by point anthem for the ethic of authenticity.
It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break the loop. No right, no wrong, no rules for me.
And the animation too. The animation is so good on this, right? She just totally transforms. Her bodily way of being goes from this kind of state. Her hair is all kind of like curled up and she's wearing these dark colors. And suddenly the hair unfurls and she makes herself this new dress. And it's like both form-fitting and flowing. And you're like, this is how she's supposed to be, right? There's freedom here, there's release, and she's singing all along the way these lyrics that are all about being herself.
And even the ice castle sort of appears, and it's a context that like comes from the text. She has a context that is itself just an expression of her individuality, right? So the individual doesn't have any sort of givens that are constraints. Rather, even though like the place that she lives in is purely just an expression of her individuality and particularity.
Yeah, yeah. And she says, like, I don't care what they're going to say, right? It's time to see what I can do, test the limits, break through. And that all feels really great.
Yeah.
But I think if we read carefully, like, Let It Go is actually an anthem of the, like, shallow version of this ethic of authenticity.
So conceal, don't feel is thesis. Let it go is antithesis.
that's not where the real resolution of the movie is.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think we're supposed to be able to see that because it kind of undoes it over over time. Right. There's no recognition that who you truly are has anything to do with your interactions with or relations with the people around you in Let It Go. Right.
Right.
It's her isolation from society is kind of portrayed as part of what it means for her to be her now. Right. Yes, I'm alone. I'm alone and free. And she overcorrects. She gets to maybe the relativist place, right? Mm-hmm. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Freedom is like rulelessness,
yeah.
Not any sort of relation to society. And what I was seeing looking around in our culture was mostly people receiving Frozen were only receiving that step,
yeah,
and not noticing the ways that that's all undercut. Elsa can't actually break off her dependence on the relationships and the place that she comes from. She can't keep it from mattering that by her storming off like this, she's turned summer into winter. Arendelle's in deep, 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 deep snow.
Arendelle's in deep, 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 deep snow.
And she can't keep it from the fact that she's going to hurt Anna again,
right?
Like the hurting Anna at the beginning was the thing that started the discipline self. And then swinging all the way over to this end also hurts Anna, right? And she can't keep Anna from mattering to her.
Elsa? Anna?
Right? This relationship is significant and it matters and it's part of who she is.
And her authentic self is fundamentally a problem for that relationship.
Whoa, Elsa, you look different. It's a good different.
It is, and yet there's a potential resolution which involves Anna's recognizing it, so not concealing it from Anna, but also not kind of just imperiously casting Anna off as a necessary precondition of having it.
You should probably go, please. But I just got here. You belong down in Arendelle. So do you. No, Anna, I belong here. Alone. Where I can be who I am without hurting anybody. So we were so close. We can be like that again. No, we can't. Goodbye, Anna. Elsa, wait. No, I'm just trying to protect you. You don't have to protect me. I'm not afraid.
She can only be her true self if Elsa is honest with Anna about who Elsa is, but also expresses who Elsa is in a way that is inclusive and sort of considerate of Anna and who Anna is and who Elsa is for Anna.
Yeah. And this is why Anna's the hero of the movie, right? And it really is a movie kind of about their relationship. It's not a movie about Elsa. Because Anna's constantly going and saying, we can fix this together, mm-hmm. but we've got to be together.
Please don't shut me out again. Please don't slam the door. You don't have to keep your distance anymore. 'Cause for the first time in forever, I finally understand. For the first time in forever, we can fix this hand in hand. We can head down this mountain together. You don't have to live in fear. 'Cause for the first time in forever, I will be right here.
Anna, but Elsa is saved by Anna's love for her, right? Yeah. And then it's precisely that love and the kind of recognizing acceptance of who she is that allows her to have her powers without them kind of being the dangerous thing mm-hmm. that they were thought to be, right? And then we get this nice resolution where you get it's not kind of an ice castle all alone. Right. It's kind of love and the open gates of Arendelle.
So what's so striking is, and I think you slightly alluded to this already, is that our culture seems to completely miss this, right? The movie comes out and everybody's just belting out at the top of their lungs, like, let it go, right? And without any sense that that is only the sort of like half-truth or that that is the overcorrection. That becomes actually the sort of takeaway of the movie is, just be yourself, other people be damned. Just realize your most authentic self. And that's, I mean, that's really, really telling. I mean, if you're right about what's actually happening in the movie, then it's really, really notable to say that, like, our culture broadly just, like, misses it completely.
I worried about that. And my poor daughter has gotten, like, a concerted indoctrination campaign never to interpret Frozen in that way, right?
So your daughter is not allowed to just watch movies as they are. She needs to also, like, conceptualize them the right sorts of way, right ways.
Maybe so.
Yeah. I wonder also if there isn't a something here actually in the history of where this film comes from, right? Like, in certain ways, Frozen is like the animated version of Wicked. Right. Which is to say it sort of stands in a sort of venerable line of sort of postmodern reinterpretations of sort of classic moralistic fables in ways that actually celebrate the villain. Right. Like, this is supposed to be the Ice Queen, the Snow Queen.
And Elsa was going to be the villain in the original version of the script.
Exactly.
And it was precisely writing Let It Go and the creative team, if I got the story right, seeing just how amazingly humanizing Let It Go was, that they're like, no, she can't be the villain.
Can't let her be the villain. That actually reminds me of a Nietzschean impulse here, right? Which is to sort of see that the fun, that the moral frame itself is problematic in its sort of repressing the life of the human being, right? He's trying to, like, accomplish something, really do something in the world. I mean, Elsa is expressing her will to power, right? In a way that, like, she never has been able to before. And it's because she got, because there is that no wrong, no right, right? She's able to sort of get beyond the moral. She's been able to get beyond good and evil. And in fact, that's what the writers have done. They have pushed beyond good and evil in order to recover this sort of expressive individualist hero. And then it's striking that the expressive individualist hero, one sort of subgenre of the expressive individualist hero, is precisely the recovered pre-modern anti-hero, or, right, sort of moralist anti-hero, or moralist, rather, villain.
So how exactly are you planning to stop this weather?
Oh, I am going to talk to my sister.
That's your plan?
Yep.
So you're not at all afraid of her?
Why would I be?
Yeah, I bet she's the nicest, gentlest, warmest person ever.
Oh, look at that. I've been impaled.
All right, so Ryan, if I'm getting you right, if we read Frozen in the very subtle, and I think we'd have to say, if we take your sort of minority report on what Frozen means, and we read against the sort of Let It Go being the anthem, we read against the impulses of our small children.
Just to say, if we read it right.
All right. Then we might be able to recover something here. I think you're maybe working harder than you need to. And instead, you might be able to just turn to a different and, I think, superior a film from this genre, which would be Moana.
Moana, make way, Moana, it's time you knew, the village of mortal new is all you need.
I think that in Moana, we actually see a bunch of the sort of concerns that Taylor raises, which I think not all of them, I don't think, are solved, even with your very subtle reading of Frozen, right? So Moana, just to set the scene, maybe a slightly less well-known film, but for Moana, there are so many moments that are very, very similar, right? Moana is also a princess, as one has to be in these movies, but she's discovering her true self, and she's discovering that her true self is in some substantial tension with the sort of established way of life of her people. And as a princess, she's supposed to be able to, you know, her responsibility is, in fact, to champion that, precisely that way of life that she's finding herself at odds with. But the crucial difference to me with Moana is that Moana is, in fact, even as she's drawn out to the sea, right? This is the big problem. This is a Polynesian island culture, and this is the culture that she's grown up in is all about the island. Stay on the island, be on the island. The island gives us what we need, is the sort of scene setting song.
The island gives us what we need. That's right, we stay. We're safe and we're well provided. And when we look into the future, there you are. You'll learn just as I did. You must find happiness right where you are.
And yet Moana is struggling with this call of the ocean. But she only listens to that call after having discovered, before she leaves her island, she discovers something about her people. It's not just about her who she is as an individual that is always going to be a problem for her relatedness to these people. In fact, as it turns out, she discovers we are voyagers, right? There have been ships hidden away on this island from generations before. I mean, worry about the cultural essentialism later. But the point is that there's an insight, and this in part comes from Moana's being drawn out to the sea. While it puts her in conflict with her father, the chief, it draws her deeper and deeper into relationship with her grandmother.
You are your father's daughter. Stubbornness and pride. Mind what he says, but remember, you may hear a voice inside. And if the voice starts to whisper, to follow the father's star, Moana, that voice inside is who you are.
And for what it's worth, that sort of a set of relationships, I actually think is highly relatable. And when I think about our undergraduates, that's often what's happening, right? There's a substantial sort of, there's a necessary adolescent sort of posture that's doing a sort of differentiation of the self away from the parent. But in this sort of postmodern ancient future sort of mode, that negotiation is often precisely through a recovery of the grandparents, right? So if you dress looking like your, you know, mom jeans, well, I guess mom jeans are back in now, but dressing like your parents.
Moms don't wear them anymore.
There you go, right. Dressing like your parents is a bad thing. Dressing like your grandparents can sometimes be hip, right? Anyway, so she has this connection with grandma, and it's because Moana has discovered we're voyagers. And sure, there's still the I've been standing at the edge of the water.
I've been staring at the edge of the water long as I can remember, never really knowing why.
How far I'll go, I guess is the name of the song, which is basically the Let It Go anthem for Moana.
I could be the perfect daughter, but I come back to the water no matter how hard I try.
And Moana's, and the climax of the film ultimately for Moana is just as it is, just as it might seem to be a sort of penultimate climax for Frozen, is a discovery for Moana, discovering who she is. But there's this moment where she says, and my daughter recognized it immediately. She knew what the moment was. She would belt it out of the top of her lungs, like, I am Moana. But we only know what I am Moana means because she has already realized we are voyagers. And that, I take it, is the instance of what Charles Taylor calls the horizon of significance, right? So Taylor's very, very concerned. While Taylor wants to celebrate this sort of particularity and the possibility that your own individual particularity could have moral significance, he's concerned that not become a celebration of difference as such.
And I think also, particularly importantly, that not be kind of a matter of choice, right? It's not just
choice.
Like the arbitrary selection of what matters to me. Right. He uses this example, like, I can't just decide that squishing my toes in the mud is the most meaningful activity.
Or that the most meaningful thing about me is the particular number of hairs that I have.
Like, you have to give some sort of account of why that matters. And what I hear you saying is that Moana is able to give an account of why her call to the ocean matters.
Yeah.
It matters because it's connected to the kind of history and vitality of her people.
Her particularity has a horizon of significance against which that difference becomes more than merely arbitrary. which I think like gives you just a much, much richer sort of sense of how this actually gets worked out.
I don't know. One of my, I think I take your reading, but like, I like what you're seeing there. One of my quibbles with Moana has to do with kind of where, I find its kind of mythology of it a little bit under motivated as well. Why the people have to be Voyagers, right? Why does that matter anymore? It all feels a little like this thing has happened elsewhere, and they kind of, I don't want to get into
Yes, it's a sort of like origins as essence sort of fallacy. Because this is what we once were. This is essentially who we
and
are.
So in the movie, right, the island stops giving them what they need, but it doesn't stop giving them what they need because, for example, the island can only give them what they need if they continue to voyage and to kind of like send the population out so that they don't crash the kind of environmental system, right? The island stops giving them what they need because like demigod did something for some reason.
The heart of Tafiti has been misplaced.
Which, I mean, there's a cool little thing there. It's great, like trying to take the power of creation from nature and give it to humans, but it's all undermotivated.
Well, I mean, look, at the end of the day, though, at least we have a cosmology, right, with Moana, which I think is another sort of point to mention here, which I think is sort of putting our hats back on as Christian theologians, not just as Disney critics. I think for us as Christian theologians, it's significant that the horizon of significance can be supplied by precisely a cosmology, a sort of story of everything, right? In the Christian frame, this would be the story of creation, fall, redemption, consummation. And that's just part of what's richer in Moana. I think it just, for me, points to the thought that even as we, as modern, postmodern, expressive individualists, are trying to express our most authentic self, it can seem at first blush that divorcing ourselves from those meta narratives is precisely the way to capture our particularity. But in the end, I think the claim that we would make as Christian theologians is that in fact, the your own particularity is able to be most fully expressed and to have the most profound meaning that it can have if it's set against the sort of horizon of significance of, I think, the story of God and the people of God, or the story of God and all that is not God.
This is the kind of most striking difference between Moana and Frozen, is that Moana starts with grandmother giving kind of a cosmological myth, and Frozen starts with, there's magic.
Right. So Elsa's able to like manipulate ice. Like, why? What on earth is the significance of that? How is that not exactly what Taylor is saying? And worried about in terms of just arbitrary difference.
Yeah, and I think this is the way a lot of us experience ourselves as kind of merely given, right? Just like a kind of a brute fact, I am this way. And Moana's kind of trying to give some sort of big account of how that makes sense or matters.
So the final takeaway then, I think even taking the two films together, might be a sort of lesson for us as people embedded in an expressive individualist you do you sort of culture, that in order to sort of fully sort of actualize ourselves, even taking that which is given to us already, even taking that as a reasonable goal to pursue, we may be able to most powerfully do that precisely in dialogue with tradition that comes before us and sort of stands outside of us and is able to
and claims about what matters apart from who we are and how we feel and what we want,
such that our choices can actually free as though we may want them to be. Our choices can be free, but also meaningful.
I grant you, and you'll be happy to hear this, Frozen's kind of lack of a big story and that being a default with compared to Moana. But I think the Christian big story is one that underwrites and at some level gives sense to the profound value of ordinary life. So when Frozen ends with basically a return to ordinary life and an integration of Elsa kind of back into Arendelle, and things just seem like they're going to go on as they go on, right? There's no big change except now there's magic ice. I think that
I find that deeply dissatisfying.
Yeah, I know. And I think, like, if we're going to talk about everlasting life, like, we might need to be able to see that as deeply good, as just kind of like given the ordinariness of createdness as a good.
So you heard it here first. Ryan's vision of the consummated kingdom of God is just ordinary life with maybe a little bit of magic ice. Sorry, that's not fair. But my concern is that whereas I am much happier, right, with the way that Moana ends, right, where the nature of life itself has been fundamentally transformed and the people are out with adventures. And we've talked about this sometimes before, you and I, that I am sort of drawn more to the heroic life. You are drawn more to sort of finding the dignity in the ordinary life. But it is interesting this that you suggest that the difference might be the way that we actually read the Christian big story, right? So for me, I have this place of sort of the role of the human being within the creation, not necessarily as heroic, but the thought that we all just like finish and go back to like. It's such an English idea, back to Hobbiton, you know, or back to, right? Like, is that the goal? Has Frodo?
It's a transfigured Hobbiton.
Yeah, right? Maybe that's right.
And I'm not saying that, like.
And I want the I want to make sure the transfiguration is like that. There is the sort of to be truly human is to be aiming at something which is like sort of beyond the human. I want more than just ordinary life.
In ordinary life, as we watch movies and TV, read books and hear stories, we often do so with our kids. How can we make more space for this kind of reading of culture? Even in the midst of enjoying art and culture, it can be enlightening and impactful to step back and see what these stories deep in our bones do to us. See how these stories charm and influence us. In the context of seeking a life that is truly worthy of our humanity, worth waking up for, worth our effort, worth striving and trying, worth doing together. In short, seeking a life worth living. Our theology must include these kinds of critical and constructive observations about the cultural movements and artifacts that we're so very attached to, including Disney films and the songs that end up stuck in your head, for better or worse. That's what makes our work at YCFC important to us. So we close this conversation thinking about why this sort of thing is even worth doing.
So this was a lot of fun. I really like having these conversations, and I could do it all day. But you do kind of have to ask the question of, like, what is there anything deeper to this than it being kind of a humanizing example we can use in lecture or anything like that, right?
No, I think that this is the heart of what we have to do as Christian theologians. Any sort of if theology is, as we argue around here, about discerning, articulating, and commending visions of flourishing life, then to be a theologian involves necessarily being a careful reader of those visions that are already out there, right? None of us are blank slates, and we're not just asking in a vacuum, what is it? What is a flourishing life? We're constantly cross-pressured by any number of cultural factors. And I think, like, in many ways, I mean, film is the most powerful medium these days in which we can really see what is the sort of vision of life that already has grabbed a hold of our hearts.
Yeah. So it's like, there's no constructing like a Christian horizon of significance kind of in isolation from the sort of streams of meaning that we're already swimming in. Right. And, I don't know. I also have the sense that if we go out and look in these sort of ways, we can find things that can give us kind of new eyes to see Christian faith and can actually contribute constructively to our own visions of a good life.
Because at the end of the day, you do you may actually be a way of beginning to a sort of thin way of finding our way into a thicker conversation about vocation, about what it is to be me as called by God, and to put it in Kierkegaard sort of terms, like what is my eternal responsibility before God to live as an individual, that is to live as the individual whom God created. And as we read culture, maybe one of the most important things to do is precisely what, Ryan, you did early on in sort of reading Frozen, which is to look for those moments in which we sort of can see, oh, that vision sort of has a pull on me, right? Conceal, don't feel. They don't even have to tell, they don't even have to use a minor chord. They don't even have to tell me that that's the wrong way to go. I just have a deep intuition, I think, given to me by my culture, that that's not quite right. And if we can be careful cultural readers that way, I think we can start to see the ways that our loves, our desires, our visions of the good have already been formed.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening, friends. And if you're interested in conversations like this beyond the podcast, then we invite and encourage you to register for the Life Worth Living online course. You can do that by visiting gracefarms.org/life-worth-living. You can find that link in today's episode show notes. And please let us know what you think of the course. If you have any questions, you can email us at faith@yale.edu. For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured Matt Crosman and Ryan McAnally-Lins. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. We produce a new episode every Saturday, and you can subscribe through any podcast app. We're grateful that you're listening to this podcast. We're passionate about making this work consistently accessible to people who are genuinely concerned about the viability of faith in a world racked with division, contested views about what it means to be human, and what it means to live life well. If you're in a position to support our show financially, please consider partnering with us. We rely on the generosity of individuals like you to make our work possible. And if you're not, please continue listening and engaging the content. Let us know what you're interested in. We're grateful that you're listening. But if you can give, if you're truly passionate about supporting podcasting that's all about pursuing really living lives that are worthy of our humanity, then consider a gift to the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit faith.yale.edu/give. It's our joy to bring these shows to you, and we'd invite you to bring that same joy in supporting this work. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll be back with more next week.